hey there, I'm Guy Branum. Welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our journalist and novelist, Margaret Wappler.
What's up, Guy?
I'm just leading my life wearing a hibiscus-bedecked sweatshirt.
This sweatshirt with a hoodie.
It's got a
hood. Don't leave that out.
Yes.
Is beautiful.
Margaret's got a simple French nautical stripe. She's ready to take to the seas and defend the African empire.
That's right.
We've got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Tongson. Karen, how you doing?
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Who are you wearing tonight, Karen?
Head to toe Muji.
Those pants are cute. And our special guest this evening, she's the host of Smart Mouth, which is such a great podcast.
Aw,
I was
you.
Delighted to discover it. It's Catherine Spires.
Hi.
Hello. Tell us more about what you do, Catherine.
I talk about the history and the culture of food. I don't really care what things taste like. We all have different taste buds.
What to you is the most fascinating food product?
Oh, my gosh. Well, okay. You said product. Tater tots.
Oh, wonderful.
Those come from just trimmins.
More food from just trimmins.
Yeah. Yes. You know? Agreed. Agreed.
It's very resourceful.
Isn't that what Scrapple is?
I love any food that came to us because of industrial waste.
Exactly.
Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about international travel, so get your passports ready. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen Tongson, what are you all about this week?
Well, it's sweeps month, and a lot of finales have come to the fore. You know, I missed out on a lot of pop culture over the last couple of weeks, so when I came back, I binged all the season finales. The ones that struck me most were, of course, Timeless. Still unclear whether it's going to be renewed on NBC, though it hasn't been axed yet, so there's hope. They left us with this tremendous cliffhanger. I'm not going to spoil it for you here, but let's just say we see a slightly buffer, more badass Lucy.
The green screen technicians of Hollywood are waiting with bated breath to find out whether they will be getting paychecks
next
year.
I love that show. And of Goran Visnjic, ER veteran, as a kind of like...
Sakina Joffrey! Indian film royalty!
Exactly. And her role's getting bigger. So, also, Grey's Anatomy ended with a wedding this season, and lots of fun hijinks in that season finale. Rise also ended, and it's not being renewed. So for those of you, that's all we're going to get. It kind of ended on a final note and a really dark one at that. But I don't know. Just get into sweeps month and enjoy it all. I'm not going to bring up The Americans because Guy will get mad at me, but I'm like waiting with bated breath for the series finale coming up soon.
Karen, I'm not getting mad at you. I'm just... paying attention to you, and as we learned in Lady Bird, what's the difference between noticing something and loving it? Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I am saying this as a reserved all about. Like, I watched the first episode of Patrick Melrose, which is the Showtime series with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Cumbersnatch.
Yeah, Cumbersnatch. Snatch is Cumber, based on the books by Edward St. Aubin. And this particular... intro to the series is really impeccably produced, beautifully acted, so stylish, so over the top in like a lot of the best ways. The only reason I say that I'm reserved about it is because it is so saturated in like his drug use that it's a hard watch. Basically, Patrick Melrose is the central character of Aubin's books. He is a aristocratic, very wealthy, heroin addicted man who has a torturous past that he's always trying to shed off of him by doing more drugs. It's really intense. It's really good. It's Jennifer Jason Leigh playing his mother. Hugo Weaving plays his dad. His dad is absolutely despicable character. I don't even want to say what's going on with the family because I feel like that's part of the discovery of the series is learning what all of their dysfunctions are. But for Benedict Cumberbatch, it is an absolute showcase for this man.
When we put together a Rocketeer's Oath, we should put a pledge in there that all Rocketeers will work to make sure Jennifer Jason Leigh gets work.
Oh, I know. Like, it was such a pleasure seeing her. I was like, yes, she's playing a fucked up mommy. This is all I want.
It sounds great. It sounds very compelling.
It is.
Catherine, what are you all about this week?
Well, quickly, I wanted to note that speaking of finales, that New Girl ended. I was that show's biggest fan, and I'm so glad it's over forever. It was time to be done. Perfect. But more importantly, so this earlier this week, Kim Kardashian posted an ad on Instagram for an appetite suppressant lollipop. That is not what I am all about. But
are you sure? I mean, is it good? Does
I'm
it gonna
try
make
it? Shed, like,
is, funny. It, is it a Dexatrim pop?
Yeah. Well, oh God, I can't imagine what it must do to your insides. Terrible.
What won't she do for 50 grand?
Well, isn't that just it, though? She doesn't need the money.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, and it didn't even have the veneer of wellness. It was just like, this will suppress your appetite, which is interesting. But the actress, Jamila Jamil, I think is how you pronounce her name.
She's done Pop Rocket.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
She guessed it when we talked about...
Royal Family, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well, eons ago, though. Yes. Not this recent Royal yes. Family.
Oh, okay, good. She plays Tahani on Good Place. She came out hard against Kim Kardashian out of nowhere. Here's why I think that is so amazing. She is a nobody, essentially, in the big world of Hollywood. The Kardashians could ruin her with the snap of the fingers. But she just came out and said, Kim Kardashian is a piece of trash. You don't need to be doing this. She dropped a lot of F-bombs. She has started a movement that now has an Instagram. It's I Weigh, with an underscore or something in there. I think that it's so amazing because she's not doing the older Hollywood model of keeping quiet and not sharing her opinions. And I kind of think that this movement of people actually saying what they're thinking comes a little bit from podcasting.
Yeah.
Because it's people with a voice who have this sort of nothing to lose attitude about it. And I feel like she's really embracing it. And I think what she's doing is probably on some level terrifying for her. I'm terrified for her. But I just think it's really cool that she's using her voice in a way that seems really real and organic.
It's all based off of this lollipop really pissed her off.
Well, she's been outspoken about these things before. Okay. She is someone who talks about body image, and apparently she was told not to move to Hollywood because she was too old and too
when
brown.
She was 29.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I am perverted enough to notice that, like, her weight does fluctuate. It's true. But she still has that face, so I'm a little bit like, you're perfection.
She's, like, she's gorgeous. And
yes.
The fact that... A, for such a long time, if you had the option of playing the hot girl in Hollywood game, you never would have done something like this.
Yes.
And also that for such a long time, we have expected intelligent women who are attractive to pretend that they were not intelligent women.
Yes.
And, like, Jamila Jamil isn't going to shut up for anybody.
No, she clearly isn't. I'm really in awe of her, because I think that if she were much more famous, I'd be like, yeah, whatever, this is, like, your cynical thing. But she's not that famous yet. And I think it's really powerful.
But I also think it's kind of a great tussle to get in the game, you know? Yeah.
There is also that.
I say that not as a criticism, but with the greatest of respect.
No, absolutely. Smart across the board in a new way, in a way that wouldn't have been recommended. And probably her agents were like, please don't. And she went for it.
Everyone is so averse to using fights to get attention. And that pisses me off so much.
So much more interesting when you do.
Should we pick a fight with some other podcast?
I mean, yes. Ooh, a much bigger and more famous podcast.
Yes.
Go fuck yourself, Marc Maron. We're done with you. Unlock the gates. Yesterday, I went with my friend Sarah to go see the documentary RBG about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Oh,
and as somebody who has a deep affection for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the fact that this documentary is helping people understand all of the work she did, you know, 20 years before she came to the court to make women in this country, like, legally equal to men, it's just delightful. There's so much stuff. Like, there hasn't been a huge amount of stuff on about her. She's been on the court for 25 goddamn years now, and it wasn't until recently that we even had, like, a good biography of her. And there's a ton of stuff, like, a bunch of footage of her husband, Marty, and so much of what made Ruth Bader Ginsburg possible in the 60s was having a husband who was willing to not be the best lawyer in his home, despite the fact that he was a very, very good lawyer. And so you really get this feeling of how Marty was great and funny and affable and was the dude who made all the phone calls so that she did get on the short list for the Supreme Court. You also kind of see the way that, you know, they always talk about her friendship with Antonin Scalia. And Antonin Scalia is basically just like the Federalist version of her husband, like big, blustery, won't shut up, and you get why she loves it. But the best thing about it, it's a very satisfying hour and a half of a movie. I forget how long it was. The two things of note are you spend, well, A, the vast majority of people you are talking to are women, and young women in the law, young women in culture, and what this person has meant to them. And but the best is you get her granddaughter, and like everyone, every descendant of Ruth Bader Ginsburg has a law degree. I'm pretty sure. Like both of her children do, even though her son doesn't practice law. And her granddaughter just graduated from Harvard Law School. And seeing this woman talk to and about Bubby is the most wonderful thing, because you also get the great feeling that their grandpa was the one who doted over them, and Bubby was the one who said, "Quiet down, I'm working." But you see her on such honest terms. Also, like, the decoration of her home and office is so avant-garde lady 1973. It is Jappy Upper West Side intelligentsia in the best of ways.
Oh, I want it.
The thing that kind of annoyed me most, there were a couple of chunks of her story that weren't part of it. You can only get so much in. But one of them was the way that she really did use, she threw herself and the women's movement in front of anti-gay arguments in front of the Supreme Court in this extremely, like, savvy way that essentially said, if you're going to say this about gay people, you have to say it about me as well, in a way that was really calculated and smart and made the past 20 years of jurisprudence on gay rights possible. It also explored the ways that she is a representative of a political sensibility not of our time, that she really is this incrementalist. Like, it talks about her as incrementalist moderate, and then also talks about the way that she has been radicalized on the court and has started basically just yelling and loving camera time. And it was interesting watching it as I hear so many people become more politicized and radical. And as a person who's 42 years old, thinking about the way I was raised up in a world, like, created by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, where, you know, just the fact of when she was in front of the Supreme Court, she was not antagonizing them. Basically, her mother told her, always be a lady, always be independent. And what always be a lady meant was don't get in fights that you don't need to. And her attitude of why antagonize someone when you're just trying to get them to where you're going. And I have always believed in that so much, and our politics now sometimes make me wonder whether lack of confrontation is the smartest way to go, but it's a great documentary.
She had her eye on, or she has her eye on the long game in such a way that I can't even really conceive of it, like having the patience to be a Supreme Court judge for this long and see things that you really believe in get sort of delayed.
Yeah.
It's kind of mind-blowing.
Or sometimes unmade, and watching that process of, you know, her first like 13 years on the court, it really was about getting O'Connor and Souter and Kennedy and Rehnquist to come together to some sort of middle path. Mm-hmm. And this world of, you know, just today we had a 5-4 that said that your employer can force you into an arbitration clause. And she issued another one of those scathing dissents. And, you know, it's hard living in this world.
A little easier with Ruth still here, though.
Yeah. More, all the more wonderful. Also, a lot of talk of neck doilies. Like, a lot of discussion of neck doilies. Mm. All right, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about international travel right after this.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the hosts of Everything's Coming Up, Simpsons. Every episode, we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright.
I got a D-minus, I passed!
And we've also had people that are on the Max Fun Network already.
Homer wearing that golf outfit is so funny. It. And there's when he gets super into golf, he's wearing the golf hat in bed.
We've had Weird Al Yankovic on the show.
I was just struck by how sharp the writing is. I mean, that's no surprise because it's The Simpsons, but I mean, like, you can't say that about a lot of TV shows, particularly ones that at that point have been on the air for 14 years.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, smell you later.
Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brandon. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson,
Catherine Spires.
And if you've been following Pop Rocket on Instagram, you are already aware that at least one panelist likes to country drop when she travels. There she is in front of the Popeyes in Hong Kong, eating noodles in Thailand. But let it be known that we all enjoy leaving the country for when the opportunity arises. So rather than let the still jet-lagged Karen Tongson regale us with exciting tales of her recent trip to multiple Asian countries, we're all going to share our stories of international travel. And the culture around international travel. I don't even know what that means today. Here's an exciting and shocking fact, everybody. I don't know that I left the country before I was 30 years old.
Wow.
I mean, I come from a working class background, where there was a basic fear of the economics of international travel. It really was, this is a way to set yourself up to some sort of trouble that will cost us a bunch of money. I remember going to my mom and saying, like, hey, Birthright will pay for me to go to Israel. And she was terrified of me being blown up. But also just sort of like, this, you know, no one I'm related to has a passport, and I'm really trying to get my niece one, so that, you know, when she does go to college, like, these things are options. But
or she can flee to Canada if they
when the shit goes down. So the only places I've been are Canada, Mexico, Australia, and the island nation of Antigua.
I mean, it's funny because, you know, whatever, I wasn't born in this country, but when we finally landed here, we didn't leave for a long time. In fact, my parents are in the Philippines for the first time in 35 years now. And I guess the only other place out of the country they've gone since is Canada, whereas we used to travel all the time. And so I didn't start traveling again until I was doing research in graduate school, And, you know, I went to the UK to go to the British Library, and it was expensive and weird and creepy, and someone tried to molest me at a youth hostel and that kind of thing. And I was like, I'm too old for this shit, no more. but I do understand that, you know, like, here in the United States, my family was very much a kind of immigrant, working, bohemian class. We didn't have a lot of extra money to go travel. We went camping a lot. So I really was, again, the kind of first in my family to start going back abroad.
Yeah.
And seeing what that was like.
What is your favorite non-United States country?
That's a really tough question.
I ask the tough questions, Ken.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to say. Obviously, you know, I really love going back to the Philippines. I had an amazing time in Thailand. I feel like such an American being like, Thailand was so awesome.
That is the most American thing to say. Yes.
It was just so amazing. But it is really profoundly awesome. I've spent a lot of time in Germany. I was with a German person for 8 years. So I've been all over the country of Germany. I have a real soft spot for it. It's a second home in many respects. But one of my favorite places to have visited is Marseille in the south of France, and I've just had the most amazing time there.
Well, that sounds lovely.
Yeah.
Catherine, what about you? What's
in terms of visiting, I was thinking that for me it's a toss-up between Vietnam and Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Cambodia was great, but I actually meant Colombia.
Cambodia.
Yeah, Cambodia is fascinating in its own right. If you do an overland transition from Thailand, if you go in a van, it's mm-hmm. like going into the Wild West. It's absolutely insane. You're shook down for money. It's dirt roads. It's casinos and hookers. It's wild. Mm-hmm. I kind of recommend it. No, but Colombia was just what I was thinking about. I really love both these countries, Colombia and Vietnam, and they're both places that a lot of Americans are afraid to go to. And I wonder if there's something about going to these places and realizing that they're great. They've got a lot to offer. I don't want to do the whole like, oh, the people are so welcoming thing.
Yeah.
There's so much colonialism and shit wrapped up in that. It's weird. Mm-hmm. But Colombia is beautiful. The cities are beautiful. Bogota has some of the most interesting museums I've ever seen. It's and then Vietnam, the beaches there are incredible. And mm-hmm. I'm partial to Vietnamese food, so that was fun.
Were you born in the United States?
I was.
When did you first leave the United States of America?
When I was 4, to go to Mexico. Uh-huh. And then when I was 9, I went to Europe for the first time. Let me explain. My dad's family is not wealthy by any means, but my grandmother was a travel agent.
Uh-huh.
And then my mom's side of the family definitely valued my grandpa was born in Germany, and my grandma was born in Hawaii when it was a territory. So their sense of like getting out there, it was big for them. So, and then they took me. That was kind of how they showed affection, was taking you places.
Yeah. Margaret, what about you?
I didn't leave the country either until 24. My parents, I think some of it is just about if your parents have the travel bug or not.
Yeah.
And my parents exhaustively traveled the U.S., but they just weren't that interested in going beyond the U.S. But I didn't leave the country until I was 24. And that was basically the first time that I got to see anything of Europe. I mean, I went to Paris and Spain and Portugal, Austria, which I didn't feel much of a connection with. Sorry to all the Austrians.
They don't want that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of felt like they didn't want me there, and I didn't really want to be there, and I was like, fine.
But Margaret,
yes,
you have 2 weeks. What do you want to do? Do you want to decompress? Do you want to go see culture? Do you want to like be in, try to simulate the experience of living in a place? What is attractive to you?
I like a mix. I mean, when David and I went on our honeymoon, and we did Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam. And I agree, Vietnam is such an amazing place. The food is so delicious. Mm-hmm. We went to Hanoi, and that was our first stop. And that's this like bustling metropolis and all these like fleets of motorcycles turning every which way on the streets and all these like sexy teenagers in motorcycle jackets. Like I was like, damn, Vietnam.
I got to ride on the back of one. A guy drove me.
Motorcycle or teenager?
No, he worked at the hotel and he took me to go get a pizza. So we went out and like came back with me holding a pizza with the other arm wrapped around him, and my hair was very long and blonde at the time.
Perfect.
We were definitely both very smug.
Yeah, it just felt really alive in a good, juicy way. But then I also wanted to do like the other side of it, which was like in Thailand, we went to Koh Tao, which is a tiny island where it's a bit more off the beaten path. I mean, a lot of surfers go there and that kind of thing. And it was a lot of us just like laying on the sand, like beached whales and going snorkeling and that kind of thing. Like, I don't want to do too much of one thing personally. Like, I like it to be a mix.
What about you, Karen?
Well, I mean, that's essentially, I always like to do a mix of things, especially if it's a place I've visited for the first time. Like this last trip to Hong Kong and Thailand, we did a little bit of both. Certainly, food is always a big part of my tourism. And so there's a lot of like, the first part of it was just kind of exploring and like, you know, getting all sorts of stuff to eat and doing like hitting all the kind of touristy spots in Hong Kong in the city, and then kind of downshifting and doing more like, oh, I'm going to go to this weird contemporary art space called Parasite.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in Thailand, again, part of the time was in Bangkok and doing the things you do in Bangkok. And another part of it was on an island that mostly Thais go to vacation, which is not far from the Bangkok metro area. It's like a 3-hour drive and an hour boat ride.
Which island was it?
Koh Samet.
Oh, okay.
I usually like to do that. But for cities that I've visited many times, like Berlin or London or other places like that, I like to inhabit it more like, oh,
like you live
I'm
there.
Going to pretend like I live here. Or I've been here enough times where, you know, I can skip that. And I can do this. I also want to make one quick pitch, though, for because y'all talking about how beautiful the beaches of Vietnam are. One of the things I think people are afraid of visiting the Philippines. It's weird, but there aren't really a lot of American tourists there, and usually only people who are like in some way affiliated with the military or other business that brings them there. But there's or with a Filipino. but they're the most beautiful beaches I've ever seen anywhere in the world, and I've been around a lot. Are in the Philippines.
But Karen, I'm worried. If I go to the Philippines, will anyone be able to speak English?
Right? yeah. Anyway. So I just wanted to make a pitch for that. But
I am
pitch accepted. I would go there in a heartbeat.
If I am in a foreign country, there is one thing I want to do without question. I want to go to a supermarket.
Oh, yes.
I want to
yes.
go to a market, and I want to walk through and understand like a little bit more about how these people's world works and how their food world works. And it was like going to a Curacaoan supermarket and there barely being availability of fresh meats, but just like a world of Dutch frozen products everywhere.
Yeah.
Was like, oh, okay, this is what's going on.
That's
here.
That's one of my major things that I like to do too. In fact, I don't tend to buy souvenirs except for things I can get, like condiments and stuff at grocery stores.
Yeah.
Like I'll take like weird mustards or pickled things or jars of stuff at grocery stores and Yeah, that's also one of my favorite things to do.
I was going to say, I love going clothes shopping anywhere where I go. Like, I have gotten things at Paris vintage thrift stores that I still have. Vietnam, I got, like, an amazing dress. Like, I just love seeing whatever the fashion is there that, like, I can get into and taking a little bit of it back. And, like, I like wearing it and being reminded of the trip. And, like, when I went to Montreal, I got, like, a great pair of earrings. Just something like that that you can still bring along with you.
What is the experience you're looking for out of?
Not shopping. That's me too much. I feel very judged when things don't fit me. Yeah. And in lots of countries they don't.
That is the rub on it.
Yeah.
Don't ever shop in Japan.
No, I know.
I bought a bunch of men's clothes in Hong Kong and in Thailand because all the pants are the right length.
Right.
Anyway.
I think the key is don't plan more than one thing per day. You can have the thing that you need to go, that you want to see.
That's wonderful.
Not more than one. The rest of the day, walk around. The last time I was in Paris, I had a morning where I just sat at a cafe on the sidewalk all morning with my hot chocolate. And that's what you want to do in Paris. And that's where you're learning the culture. On a previous trip to Paris, I had been at the Louvre and I was walking into the museum and there was a group of teenagers just literally collapsed on the floor of the museum. And as I'm passing by, I heard one of them go, "But why did we have to come to the Louvre right from the airport?"
Oh, no.
And I thought, what are these teachers doing? They're trying to, you know, they'd get more out of the experience by going to the cafe and doing the sidewalk culture. And instead, they're going to cry. And all they're going to remember is that you don't actually see the Mona Lisa. You see the people taking pictures of the Mona Lisa. That's going to be it. Don't stress yourself out. Also, if you don't see everything, that's great. You have a reason to go back.
Yeah. Do you hyper prep or do you ever just let a city wash over you?
I can sometimes do that. I think, okay, there's the one activity per day, but the most important thing also is book a hotel for the first night, right when you land. A lot of people are like, oh, see what happens when I get there. Not the first night.
Yeah.
That's too much. Have a landing pad, have a place to sleep. But then other than that, honestly, like the walking around. Mm-hmm. It's how you don't want to just see the museums. That's not the real culture.
Flânerie.
Yes, exactly. You get it.
Yeah, I mean, like, the things I always want to know is, what is the thing I am supposed to eat here? And what is gay like here?
Yeah.
Because it is, even within this country, like, it's so fun to be like, all right, what does Wichita have to throw down with?
Yeah.
And one of the weird things about the Caribbean was just, like, Curaçao and Puerto Rico are essentially the only places with, like, much of a queer culture, because it's not dangerous to be gay in any of those other places. But the question of, like, I deeply, when I go somewhere, want to know, what am I supposed to eat here? Like, having a real sense of that, and it was one of my huge problems with Toronto, was I didn't know how I was supposed to be engaging Toronto on that front. And then finally somebody was like, you need to get Pakistani food in the suburb of Brampton. And
wow, so specific.
Love it. That's great.
And that was the answer.
Yeah. That's usually the answer for me, too, is that, I figure out what's the migrant or immigrant population in this particular place, and then that's where you go for good food that's not going to cost you too much. So, you know, like whether or not it's having Turkish food in Germany, all throughout Germany. Like, it's like, to the, you know, get a döner or something like that. Or, just figuring out those little things. Or going to, like, eat street food or whatever the equivalents are, like, little kiosk things. I'm always going to, like, track down the lady with the kind of charcoal kettle slung over her shoulder, cooking some random piece of meat on the beach. I'm going to eat that first before I book myself a Michelin-starred restaurant.
When I was in Antigua, I was like, where are we supposed to eat? Where are we supposed to eat? And there was no restaurant. And then finally, I asked a lady, like, where do you get food? Like, a woman who worked at the hotel. And she was like, well, go to the tamarind tree across the street. And, like, all of the Antiguan restaurants I went to were just sort of, like, thrown up under a tree or something like that. And it was fucking magnificent. And then back at the hotel, we were having, you know, boiled English food.
Also, always look for the place that is full of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially like if you're going the guidebook route, you'll show up and there's no one else there except for another American couple. And you're like, I think something has gone wrong. And it has. Go to a place with a crowd.
Is there pop culture that you have picked up while abroad that you are deeply in love with? Why don't I begin with two? First, let us speak of New Zealand's top model. I was in Australia and they were showing New Zealand's top model. And I did watch some episodes of Australia's Top Model, and it was fine. But New Zealand's Top Model was full of women who did not know how drama worked. And watching nice people be on Top Model was just one of the most satisfying things I have ever experienced. And then the other thing is, when I was in Antigua, I went to look and see if Netflix would work, and Netflix did work, and Netflix was like, here's the movie you want to watch, and it was... this is Curacao, I think I said Antigua. It was Curacao's, like, splashy comedy from the Curacao who had gone to the Netherlands and essentially become their Eddie Murphy. And so it was a big-budget comedy where he played, like, six roles Nutty Professor style and was, like, an action comedy. And there is something so beautiful about the fact that so frequently other cultures are 10, 15 years later trying to remake beloved American tropes and seeing the Netherlands do its best to make its 48 hours was like, it's called Bomb Binny Holland and it's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
One thing that I always do traveling in foreign countries is I don't travel expensive, but I always want to go to the fanciest hotel in the city and have a drink in their lobby.
Nice.
It's very important to me. It's where I, you know, you drop $30 in half an hour.
Yeah.
And when I did that in Phnom Penh in Cambodia, there was a drink named after Jackie Kennedy.
Whoa.
And that, I think, was actually my first inkling of the Camelot thing with the Kennedys. Because I was like, why do they care? And it's a champagne and cognac and some creme de something that makes it pink. And it was very important, a very important moment that the Kennedys came there. And so I was like, oh, I'm finding all this about like the story of the Kennedys here in Cambodia. Didn't expect it.
No.
Can I tell you guys a little story about how when I was in Austria, I went to the bar called the American Bar.
Oh, no.
And it's really, I mean, no, it's really good. It's like a really,
really
cool place. Yeah, it's like Ernest Hemingway used to drink there and that kind of thing. Like a much more like speakeasy vibe. You know, it was all like low lit and candles and very beautiful. And I sit down next to this guy and we start talking and it turns out we worked at the same place in Chicago.
No.
Can you believe that? I mean, that was hilarious to me that, like, I picked this place called the American Bar and then ran into an American
That's
who,
wonderful.
Like, shared part of my life practically. But, you know, pop culture-wise, discoveries. I think when I went to Tokyo, I went to go see this big concert that I was brought out there as a journalist to go see a big concert that was playing at the National Olympic Stadium that they built for the Olympics a number of years ago. And they were basically going to tear the stadium down, and because they were going to tear it down, they had this huge show. And one of the bands that played there is this band called Perfume. It's this Japanese trio, and they're basically like kind of like the Destiny's Child of Japan.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's like three women, and they have beautiful harmonies, and they all descended the stage in these like glowy neon boxes, and like they're all wearing like little trim outfits and do like little cute robot dances. And I got into them after that. Like, it was a good way to just, I mean, seeing a band live, like, with the people is, and also concert culture in a different country is amazing. Like, so much, I mean, I know
how
this is kind of.
How orderly was that exit?
I was going to say, like, this is a stereotype about Japan that they're, like, polite and quiet, but they really were polite and quiet. And, like, they had these, like, neon lights that they gave out to everyone, and they just coordinatedly, like shone the lights and like, waved them in the air all at the same time. I mean, it was.
Just pretty like the baseball kind of, games there.
Yeah.
Is that what they do at the baseball games?
Yeah,
they have organized cheering sections.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Very interesting. I love it. But, you know, pop stars hate playing acoustic sets in Italy because they'll be like, okay, we're going to quiet it down now. And in most countries, people are like, okay, we're going to listen to this. Not in Italy. The screaming continues apace.
Poor Ed Sheeran. No, I mean, the pop culture things that I've found. Also in Japan, the Takarazuka Review. I don't know if any of you have heard of this. It's a all-female performance ensemble and troupe. And they, so that means that some of the actors play male roles and some play female roles, they have such a huge swooning housewife following that it's just as fun to go see the fans. These like middle-aged Japanese women swooning over like, you know, women cross-dressing as men, essentially.
Wow, nice.
And so that's really exciting. There's actually a great documentary about that and the fan culture around it. When I was traveling a lot in Europe in the 90s, when I was in graduate school, that's when I got to learn about all of the lesser boy bands of different European countries.
Wonderful.
And so, you know, like, I mean, I know that people knew about Boyzone here, they're from the UK, here in the States a little bit, but it was like deep. You know, I got really deep into it. Also, of course, a few German bands who are never going to break over here. Like, I got to know the Deep Nina catalog, but also there was a band called Wir sind Helden, We Are Heroes, and I kind of got into them for a little bit and tried to be, like, super continental and brought their CDs back. Expensive hotel bars. In Hong Kong recently, I went to the Intercontinental, which sits on the bay on the Kowloon side with a gorgeous panoramic view. And I got the conversion wrong with currency. And I got the zeros mixed up. And what I thought, I was like, this is amazing. This rare rye is only $3.
Oh, no.
I ordered two $30 ryes. And lucky I didn't get one of the Japanese.
That's a good thing to do on a trip.
But
just go for it.
Put it on the Amex. But I'm lucky I didn't order one of the really fancy Japanese whiskeys that had an additional zero.
Yeah.
I would be like, oh, whoa, that sent me back $500 or something. So be careful.
Right. You do have to be careful. But I do zeros. Think it's important to try. Not that rye is necessarily known, area of the world, but when I was in Mexico City, I dropped some dimes on mezcal, no regrets.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And they have some crazy mezcals there where it's like, this one is made inside of a chicken breast for 30 days or whatever. It's like, okay. And then you try it and it's like, you can still actively taste blood, but that's okay. It's really good.
I have had very bad experiences with tequila, but when Chelsea Handler took us to Mexico after she hosted the VMAs, MTV like sent a mariachi band and this dude to do like a tequila tasting with us, and it was there that I fell in love with mezcal. Like,
yes,
it is
the
just
best.
It's wonderful.
Well, I mean, I think LA is on the mezcal tip because we're like close enough, and are bartenders that kind of know about it. I don't know if it's like really in New York or other places quite as much.
No, it's the biggest in LA for sure. Yeah. We have entire mezcal. I think it tastes like rubber, but clearly I'm wrong.
I love it. Is there a film of international travel that like particularly speaks to you? To me, Before Sunrise, I have never seen the other two movies in the little trilogy, or I think maybe now there are four, because I'm always scared to feel that much, because the first one that I watched, you know, when I was in my 20s, just struck up my very soul. And even though I haven't traveled that much, this romanticization of meeting someone and having like fleeting time with them in this place that was ridiculously beautiful and like full of culture and history, I'm a big fan of.
Oh, that's so beautiful. there isn't like a movie about travel, but the movie Hero, which is a Chinese movie that came out in 2002, and it has Jet Li and everybody in it. It made me want to go to northwestern China.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of about travel because they have to go across the steppes of Mongolia.
Yeah.
And it's such a beautiful movie and it's shot all on location. And I want to go there and I want to go there and I want to do that and I want to do all the kung fu moves. Like, it made me very, like, stupid and silly in how much I wanted to go there.
Like, Muslim China just seems like such a fascinating place to visit.
So fascinating. I went to Xi'an, which is where the Terracotta Army was. And that's why we went there, to see the Terracotta Army. I was with a friend who was an archaeologist. I didn't care, but we went there. And then I found out that it's the end of the Silk Road and that it's Muslim and that there's a market there with food. And that's the first time I learned about Chinese Muslim food, which is one of the best foods on the planet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Does traveling into a Wes Anderson movie count?
Yeah. Yes.
Because Darjeeling Express, like, even though I'm pretty positive that never existed then or now. Still looking at that movie and imagining that that's what India is like, and that you can take like a beautifully appointed train like through the mountains of India. It's a fantasy. I could get into it.
I think the Peter Ustinov Hercule Poirot films, Evil Under the Sun, and, you know, like, it made everything look so glamorous and lush. Also, the talented Mr. Ripley. I feel like I always have fantasies about traveling in another era. Things like the talented Mr. Ripley, or even, problematically, the English Patient, you know.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of travel movies are kind of problematic. But, I meant to say Darjeeling Limited, by the way, but yes.
Let us talk for a moment about A Room with a View, because the children have forgotten A Room with a View. Like, people under 30 don't know. It's this lovely Merchant Ivory film based on an E.M. Forster novel about a young girl who, with her aunt as chaperone, heads to Florence.
Yes.
And it does such a great job of parodying travel culture, like the signora at their pensione has a Cockney accent, and everybody is just constantly bitching about lemonade or whether they've boiled the meat too much. But also this real sort of like celebration through the camp of people outsourcing big emotions to another part of the world, and it like both makes fun of that and lets it happen, and then takes you back to Britain and lets you see this shit play out.
Isn't it extraordinary? I mean, Italians are so kind, so lovable, and yet at the same time so violent. Miss Emerson, I've never been so much ashamed of myself in my life. I can't think what came over me.
That's perfectly natural. I nearly fainted myself.
It's such a fun little movie. And, you know, a young Helena Bonham Carter as proxy for E.M. Forster as, like, her deep need for dick and emotional, like, arousal.
You just described my jam. I mean, that's...
It's so good.
Yeah. Who doesn't want that combo?
Not me.
Just supply something else for Nick.
I'll take Karen's.
Well, I'll do Marguerite Duras, the film adaptation of Marguerite Duras, The Lover, like, was a kind of a different, like, sort of, like, weird orientalized Franco-orientalized way of looking at myself and the world anew. And that made me want to visit some of the places in that film.
Here's the thing. Three of us here are women. Two of us here are queer. One of us is a person of color. Is there anywhere that you want to go to deeply that you would not go to for one of those reasons? I am fascinated by Jamaica. Like, I have a preoccupation with the Caribbean, as should be clear. It is, like, the British Caribbean that is sort of most interesting to me. But also, and like, Jamaica is the fucking jewel of the British Caribbean. And I think I would probably never go there because I don't know. And I'm also gigantic. Like, I normally, sometimes I will, like, go places and I'll, like, read travel warnings and be frightened. And it's like, God, they're not talking about you. but I don't think I would go to Jamaica.
That's actually one of the top places on my list that I'm probably never going to end up seeing unless something dramatically changes because of the homophobic violence, and also particularly against women.
Yeah.
There are, like, so many activists who've died from bashings. And so I probably won't ever see you, Jamaica. Also, Russia is off the list these days. And in that particular region, some of the drama around, you know, persecuting homosexuality. Yeah, that's probably not going to ever happen.
Would you ever go to, like, the UAE?
I might. Yeah, actually, that's the thing, is that I don't feel worried about traveling to the UAE in any, but I do, you know, I have thought about it a little bit. My wife has traveled a lot more in the Middle East than I, and she's like, the thing is, you'd be wrapped up, so, like, no one would know what was under there.
Well, I feel a little bit weird about going to a country where I know that I will be safe, but they are still arresting gay dudes.
Yeah.
You know? What about you guys?
Yes, for sure.
I think that just as a woman reading travel warnings and that sort of thing, I read them and they're like, this place might not be safe for women. I'm like, oh, no kidding. Might it not? It kind of almost doesn't even matter. Nowhere is that safe for me, really. Yeah. I mean, I've gotten hassled everywhere I've gone, including in my neighborhood. So who cares?
Catherine, let me tell you a delicious story.
Yes.
I was in Cabo with Chelsea. And we were at some trashy, trashy place where spring break kids get you drunk. And I decided to range off on my own.
Yeah.
And Chelsea pulled off one of her four bodyguards and was just like, follow him. And there's nothing better than just bouncing around the seedy part of town with just like a man who to me seemed gigantic, making sure nothing goes awry. I can't recommend it highly enough.
That's a good way of looking at it.
As a woman, I had a pretty uncomfortable experience in Morocco. Like, I was really young. It was in that 24-year-old trip. I didn't dress in a way that was probably smart for going there, and I got harassed pretty intensely.
Would you not have gotten harassed as much if you had been dressed differently?
I think I would have not been harassed as
really?
Much. Yeah, because I was wearing a tank top and a skirt, and I just didn't know. Nobody warned me, nobody told me. I wasn't, you know. This is like before the internet really was supplying this kind of travel information where now you could look this up so easily. And I just didn't know. And so I came there and it was just like a boat cruise to Morocco for a day. And we were walking around in like a spice market and things like that. And it was bad. But, you know, that said, I would definitely go there now or really any place. I think you can travel a lot of places if you just take the right precautions. But mm-hmm. I kind of have an answer to your question that's like a little bit about being a white person going to a place and not knowing how to do it in a non-exploitative way. And like I think about that with like going to like a Native American reservation, for instance. Like I don't know how to go to a place like that without feeling kind of gross about it. And then I'm like being the weird white person looking at animals in a zoo. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I've never gone to a reservation, even though I've been curious, and want to support those communities, but don't know that that's like the best way to support them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think
the best way to support them is, of course, blackjack. I mean, the thing is, I have been to Native American reservations, but only technically. Like, the one square block of Palm Springs that is a Native American reservation.
What? There's so, a yeah. one square
casino.
The
Agua Caliente.
Okay.
Yeah, that's owned by the Agua Caliente people. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting, though, to travel in an interracial couple, as an interracial queer couple, because our concerns are very different often. And obviously, those of you who follow me on Twitter know that I'm constantly tweeting about my bathroom drama when I'm traveling, because there are times where I've traveled to some countries in Asia where I just pretend I'm a man the whole time because I don't want to deal with it. Like in Korea, it's just like I'd even wore my like femmiest outfit to go to the Korean spa in my hotel. It's like got this giant boat neck and it's wearing like little capri, like spandex capris, and you know, and my hair is the way it is. And like the person checking me in saw that I was a woman, but someone from behind was like, wait. And I was like, no, I'm look at me. I'm wearing this faggiest outfit in the world. And but so there are like, so mostly in Korea, like I'm essentially, I was like, here I go. You know, I don't identify as trans, but I'm going to be, you know, traveling trans while I'm here. So it's really, that's always a stressful thing for me, is wondering how people are going to deal with the gender stuff. Whereas in a place like the Philippines, there's a kind of wider range of gender expression. Also, for those of you who don't know, Bangkok is one of the most fun lesbianic cities I've ever been to.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
You think it's going to be all gay guys, but then, we were out on a Sunday and we ran into, on the island, first of all, like the first people we see is like a trans woman, a gay couple, and then suddenly like lesbians taking like deep photo shoots like on the beach. And there's so many butch lesbians all over Bangkok.
I was gonna say, I think the sex industry there like has obviously a very dark underbelly, but there's also like the positive end of it, which I think is a little more like acceptance of just all kinds of like gender expressions and all of that. But you know, when you were in that Korean spot, did you feel like you're betraying yourself somehow, or did it just feel like this is what I have to do to get along in this
country?
I'm just
like, this is what I'm gonna have to do just to get into the spa, and once I'm there everyone will see my naked naked body anyway.
But I do have that outfit.
I think I should start traveling with large
like your one femme
large
outfit.
Hoop earrings. Like my friend Raquel and I always said as a joke, like this like the butch, you know, like emergency kit would involve two large hoop earrings.
That's hilarious.
Like, break the glass. There are the hoops. It's okay, everybody. Yeah. It's okay.
A little lip gloss. But,
I did really enjoy you serving Butch Sarong realness this last vacation.
Yes.
All right. Well, please get in the conversation. Let us know about your experiences with international travel or the culture of international travel on the Facebook group. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hey there, folks. I'm writer and performer Dave Holmes, and I host International Waters, where we pair a team of comedians in L.A. against a team of comedians in London in a pop culture trivia battle royale. Comedians like Chris Fairbanks.
Yeah. I have a metal hip.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
How's that going?
I'm part robot. It's
You're
great.
More machine than man.
It feels great. I'm mostly man still.
Okay.
That depends on where I'm at, though.
Lauren Lapkus.
But I do think if you're working with dead bodies all day, maybe a dog would be more appealing than marrying a man.
Yeah, right.
So. Like, it's like, oh, this is going to get really sad at some point. Yeah. So maybe I'll just marry
Seriously.
A dog and always replace it. A lot of cuddling.
Yeah. A lot of cuddling. And many more. Join us every other week on International Waters with me, Dave Holmes. Find it on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson,
Catherine Spires.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask, what's your current jam? And since Margaret Wappler has a human being to feed, she's going to give us her jam and head out.
My jam is from Henry Green. I discovered this song because recently I wrote my first celebrity profile in quite some time since having a baby, basically. And I have to say, it felt nice. It felt nice to be back into the warm embrace of magazine frivolity. It's Jenna Dewan that I wrote about. And probably by the time this episode comes out, the piece will be out. So that's Channing Tatum's ex-wife, for those of you who don't know. She's an astounding dancer in her own right. She is the host of the World of Dance. Anyway, she made this video of her dancing in a cove. I don't know, but she's on the sand, and it is to the song from Henry Green called Something, and it's just really beautiful and lush and this nice cut of escapism. Keep letting the sun
That's not W Hotel Elevator. That's W Hotel Pool.
I was going to say, I think it's W Hotel Massage. Like, that is some scented oils of a very expensive variety being pampered all over your body.
It pulsed. Spires, you got a jam?
Yes, and admitting to this is my greatest humiliation. It's a singer named Charlie Puth.
Oh, yeah.
Who started by uploading his own songs to YouTube, and then he was hired to sing the tribute to Paul Walker that Wiz Khalifa produced, See You Again. But this song is called Done For Me. It features the singer Kehlani. They're both small children, but I just love this song. I feel like it's tacky of me. I love it. You say you're leaving. Well, if you wanna leave, there ain't nobody stopping you. No, oh, baby, no. I won't beg for your love. Won't say please. I won't fall to the ground.
Catherine, if you're ever embarrassed to like a song, I'm going to really enjoy it.
Like, okay, good. I mean, it's catchy, right?
Yeah. And you know, Charlie Puth is huge in the Philippines.
Oh.
Yeah, he's really, really famous there in a way that he's not even as famous here yet. But he's got a couple tunes that are just so insidious.
He's so one of those like tiny little white boys who has more of a voice than you would expect.
Yeah.
And it's great, I think.
As Margaret flees to go take care of her child, I will share my jam, which is a podcast. I'm sorry I'm cheating. But as I said before, I am withholding myself from music to cleanse my soul in preparation for Summer Jam 2018. Catherine, if you have any nominations for Summer Jam 2018, we look forward to hearing them.
Sounds good.
But I have a podcast that I haven't fallen in love with. Beth Newell, one of the founders of Reductress, and Peter McNerney, a really funny improviser from New York, have two children and two Instagram feeds, which I'm obsessed with, where they show their children being the worst people and the best comedy team I have ever experienced. And now they have a podcast about it. I don't know who this podcast is for because I just see it as an after show for their Instagram. But really, it is a great and very relatable parenting podcast that I, as a non-parent, enjoy the hell out of. Every week, they talk about just what the two of them experienced raising those kids. They interview Bryn and Maven. This year, or this week, it ended with Bryn loudly shouting at Peter, "Maven doesn't like you, Maven doesn't like you." But the best part of the show is each of them constructs every week a Kobayashi Maru scenario, an unwinnable situation for a parent, and the other one has to say how they would handle it. I would like to briefly give you the one that Beth presented to Peter this week. It was, you pick the kids up at daycare, they are super hungry, there is nothing to eat at home, and so you take them to the burger place in between daycare and our house. You get them food, sit them down, and Maven shoves a chicken finger so far back in her throat that she vomits a little bit on the front of herself and somewhat on Bryn. While you are trying to clean up Maven, Bryn walks over and starts talking to another family with a visible amount of vomit on himself. What do you do?
Okay, I grab Bryn. If he screams, full fireman carry over the shoulder. Maven will probably walk because she's a little shell-shocked from the vomit, I assume.
So,
well, how's she behaving?
In order to do this, you're not going to have time to do the full vomit cleanup.
Oh, I know. Yeah, no, this is what I called full retreat. Where I grab him over the shoulder, I grab her hand, hopefully she walks. If not, I'm ready to pick them both up. And I go straight for the door. I make zero eye contact with anyone.
It was terrifying and exciting, and their like their radical honesty about parenting, I think, is liberating and the best.
Amazing.
Wow.
So get on board. Karen, you got a jam?
Backstreet's back. They have a brand new single. It's called Don't Go Breaking My Heart, which is not a cover of the Elton John song, so don't be confused.
The Kiki D song, you mean?
Elton and Kiki. And it was just dropped May 17th, and it's a preview of what's going to be coming on their new studio album in the fall. They've been doing really well in Las Vegas. For those of you who didn't catch the Backstreet Boys documentary that they had on Netflix a little while ago, please do watch that as well. So here we go. Don't Go Breaking My Heart.
I'm not that kind of person who can fall in and out of love with you. That's not what love's supposed to do. Baby, don't go breaking my heart, breaking my heart.
Why aren't 45-year-old men allowed to make pop music?
Yeah, why not?
I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think that actually they are allowed to make pop music as solo artists often. Like, yeah. You know, you got Timberlake's not quite that old yet, but, and neither are the most of the Backstreet Boys. I think Kevin's the oldest. I don't know why I know this. but it's, I think that the song itself, though, has that little touch of mystery and maturity to it.
That song sounded like a perfect gym jam.
Yeah, it's a really good, like, cool down jam.
Yeah.
Or warm up.
Music for the gym is extremely important.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brannon. I have a book. It is coming out July 31st. I'm sorry I keep hawking it, but I need to make money from my book. My life is a goddess. So please pre-order it now. There's Margaret Wappler, who left. There's Karen Toxin, who has her own hybrid memoir coming out in January.
Why Karen Carpenter Matters.
Get on it. And Catherine Spires, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Thoroughly delightful. Where can people learn more about you?
On Instagram, there's at SmartMouthPodcast and also at Catherine_Spires.
And do you have an Instagram that is just about your burgundy leggings? Or is
wouldn't you love that?
I would love it a lot. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone who gave us 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Margaret's not here. She could be, like, her bones could be cracking as we speak because you have not given reviews to keep her healthy. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket. Follow us on Instagram. We're at Pop Rocket Podcast. Or join our Facebook group and be part of the discussion like Ms. Catherine Spires is on so many occasions, like you weren't a goddamn podcast celebrity yourself. We are a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by Julian Burrell, and our producer is Laura Swisher, who has been to, like, 3 of my savers.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.